This is Where Did the Road Go? Our aim is to explore the fringe, to be true skeptics and question openly, to investigate the paranormal, bring light to the dark corners of history, and give a voice to the shunned of science. We deal in mystery and the important questions that these subjects bring to light. What is reality? Who are we? And why are we here? Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com for a full show archive, links to all our social media, upcoming schedule, and much, much more. Now, join your host Soraya on this week's edition of Where Did the Road Go?
Welcome to the show. This week on Where Did the Road Go? We welcome back Edmund to Marriage. Edmund had been on a few times at the end of 2014. And the information Edmund has is just, it's fantastic. And if you want to see, it backed up, if you feel he's not backing up what he's saying, go check out his video series, Learning from History, I believe is what it's called. He'll mention it here in the very beginning of the interview. Fascinating stuff. And I think he's actually on to something. I think he's probably in the right direction, if nothing else. And we're going to talk about the end of the last world, the end of the Ice Age, and the restart of civilization, and all that entails here in the next hour or so. So enjoy my talk from a couple nights ago with Mr. Edmund Marich. All right, welcome back to the show, Edmund. It's been a while since we talked with you.
Great to hear from you.
And how are you doing?
I'm fine. I'm buzzing. I've got lots happening, and I'm really enjoying life at the moment.
That's awesome. And you have a very interesting trip coming up.
Yes, we have an organization which is called the Association for the Protection of Lebanese Heritage. And it's a very high-powered individual, a very competent man in Beirut, has set this organization up to protect all the important archaeological sites in the Lebanon. It's never been done before in what I call a really constructive way. And he has listed the Garden of Eden site as the second site for protection. He's already done a great deal of work on the Spanish embassy, which is a very important ancient building, and he's decided that he wants to put the Garden of Eden site next on the list for providing information and publicity to not only the people of the Lebanon, but also the people of the world.
Okay. Now, where is this? Is this a confirmed site by him, or is this the site you feel is the Garden of Eden?
He has looked at the evidence which we have provided and is satisfied that it should be high on the list or second on the list for protection. He's had all the information which most of the people who have looked at my Learning from History series have seen. There's now 15 of them. He has the book, which is The Shining Ones, written by Christian and Barbara Joy O'Brien. And we are looking through, and he's looking through now all the detailed evidence to find the best ways in which we can get this message across to people as a serious message of something of immense importance, particularly as we've got so much trouble, if you like, and conflict between ISIS and obviously between the Christians, Islam, all the religions of the area, and there are very many religions of the area. The Druze are the people on site here, and many of the local people have knowledge of its importance in the ancient past. Mount Hermon itself, and the site is just below Mount Hermon. Mount Hermon has more stone structures, which some people would call temples, but certain more stone structures than almost any other site on the planet, which emphasizes the importance of Mount Hermon and the area. And Mount Hermon in the Bible is where the sons of God lived. Just one of the many, many clues. That the really important clue, I believe, is the work that I put together on agricultural origins, where we can trace and get tremendous support from science, which already exists, of where we find the first domesticated crops, the wheats, the barleys, the peas, the beans, the vetches, something like 24 principal domesticated crops, quite different from the wild ones, which are all arriving around the same place at the same time in what is called the Levantine Corridor, which is Carsag is part of that Levantine Corridor, and in fact the headwaters of the River Jordan. And it runs from effectively from Damascus down to the Dead Sea at Jericho.
Okay. And obviously people know the biblical story of the Garden of Eden. What do you believe the Garden of Eden actually was?
Well, the most important quotes in the Hebrew Bible, which was put together by Ezra in exile from the earlier cuneiform records and what I call the archaic Hebraic writing, and it was put together, and this is something that O'Brien deals with in great detail. There is an alternative Genesis on the Golden Age Project site, which people can look at, and they'll see that some of the key points, and it doesn't take many changes or proper understanding of the translations to see that what we have is not God in heaven. And the word earliest words for God were Elohim, which is in fact a plural word. And heaven is a word which, the word for heaven is a Hebrew word, which is Hashemin. Now, if we look at the Elohim word, we're looking at the bright or shining ones. And the Hashemin has this roots of Shem, seed, in the middle of it. And that translates as the planted highlands. So when we really reassess and look, using all the much earlier evidence, we find that Elohim in the planted highlands, it's not God in the planted highlands, it's a group of people, although their leader was regarded as God, and his name was An. When we read the Quran, we're reading the readings and recitations of An. And so we're getting a wonderful story of a group of people who settled and started agriculture and gave civilization to the human race after the great Younger Dryas Ice Age, when the planet began to warm up at about 9,500 BC.
And this is a very popular subject at this point. Graham Hancock, obviously coming out with his new book, Magicians of the Gods, is making a lot of people look at this more intensely. And what do you feel happened that ended the last ice age?
I think we have to start with what caused the Younger Dryas Ice Age. And Hancock deals with that quite well. I dealt with this in Learning from History Part 1 in 2007. And I used the work of Professor Victor Klube and the Torrid debris, cometary debris. But this was superseded by Richard Firestone's work, which is called The Cycle of Cosmic Catastrophe. And what we find at round about 10,850 BC, we have the remnants of a supernova explosion blasting through our solar system and causing absolute mayhem, dislodging planets, a major collision breaking one of the planets into bits, the atmospheres of the Earth and Mars very seriously affected by this cometary debris. The Earth's atmosphere was definitely thinned by maybe 20%, 30%. Mars may have lost its atmosphere at that time, which is a very recent period of time. And all the research that's being done on Mars now is showing that it's far more likely to have had life than people realize. And with water still flowing, or forms of water still flowing, salt water, then we have to look at that whole theory of the cycle of cosmic catastrophe, and also the work which backs it up by Cataclysm by Bernard Dallaire and Derek Allen. And there's much more work now available. So Great Younger Dryas Ice Age was literally happened after the Earth was tipped on its axis, where water flooded across the planet. Much of America has all the evidence of recent massive movements of water across the surface. And many archaeologists have begun to understand that, geologists in particular. I've got several papers in my files which Bernard Dallaire has sent me, which give very good explanations that we had a mass of water, not only flowing across America, but virtually every other continent, and massive vertical movements of the Earth's surface. And when you have that kind of problem, you have so much cometary strikes in North America, for example, in the Hudson Bay region, one in the region between Finland and Sweden, and we're seeing that would have created so much debris that it would have literally closed the planet down and frozen it over. And of course, it was about a 1,500-year freeze, with 40% of the planet actually frozen solid. This is a time, too, when we get all those gases and nitrogen, all the debris from a supernova explosion, literally hitting the mammoths on the steppe. They had food in their mouths, and that area was chilled to a depth of about 200 feet. Literally frozen solid. That's why we're excavating mammoths have still got plants in their mouths that they were eating at the time. And there's a whole range of really interesting evidence to show that was, in fact, Firestone and et al., they all make the point that it was the greatest mass extinction on this planet Earth for something like 3 million years. And that's when we lost all those very large saber-toothed tigers, sloths, mammoths, etc.
Okay, and so was there an actual ice age before the Younger Dryas, or was the Earth just on a different tilt?
Before the Younger Dryas ice age, we had in Britain, for example, in our Peak District, we had ibis. We had the kind of birds you find in Egypt. So there was a warm period before the cometary debris or remnants of a supernova explosion came through our system. They were the heavy objects which traveled at the slowest speed. In reality, the first flash, which wiped out all the large animals on the Australian side of the continent, that happened in... I think it was 39,000 BC, a long while before. And this supernova explosion was something like 200 light years away. So it's the mechanics of supernova explosions. We're actually now told that there have been, over the last 10,000 years, eight smaller supernova explosions, which the evidence has been observed of that. But it's a very complex subject, obviously. But in simple language, whoever was around in 10,800 managed to survive the most appalling conditions and were able to start again at 9,500 BC when the climate changed quite dramatically. Now, this, all these climate change movements in the past from the records, we know happened quite quickly. It got cold extremely quickly, but it warmed up quickly too. And so the area which I'm talking about was a glacial refuge of all the important grasses, and plants, the pistachio, the oak, and a survival area for a lot of the animals too, like a red deer and antelope, etc. And so the Levantine Corridor was a very important glacial refuge, as it's called, for all the things that we would have needed if we were going to start again. And the site that was chosen below Mount Hermon. And the key there is that that mountain range, which is the called the Anti-Lebanon, on the other side of the Rift Valley, it's the Lebanese Mountains, but they carry snow for something like 6 months of a year. So what you had at that point in time, which was very dry when the earth recovered, was this snow melt water. And the snow melt water was crucial for the irrigation of agricultural crops. We see the same technology, same techniques, same concepts used much later in the Andes, where people rely on the snow melt water from the Andes to provide irrigation, especially during the important growing season of all the plants and crops which they grew for food.
Okay, so before the Earth tipped, though, where would the North Pole have been?
The North Pole would have been over the Hudson Bay area.
Okay, so where the magnetic North Pole was.
Yeah, and so this is one of the reasons why there was so much ice and eventually discharge of water from all the great areas around the Hudson Bay, which would have been rather like the ice cap of the Hudson Bay at that point. But of course, what the impact did was shifted the Hudson Bay North Pole north to more or less where it is now. So North America would have been very much more affected, if you like, by an ice cap. And then that ice cap was literally tipped south and melted very rapidly. Part of a complex process if you have a great big sphere and you start throwing large stones at it, all sorts of things happen.
Okay, so it was the actual impact that shifted the axis of the Earth.
Yes.
Okay.
Although, can I just qualify that?
Yeah.
Some of the scientists say that in order to tip the Earth on its axis, even if you had a lot of cometary impacts, you actually required torque from a large object which passed close to the Earth. And some scientists believe that the torque to tip the Earth on its axis, to move the Hudson Bay Pole to Hudson Bay North Pole to where it is now, would have taken a very close pass by a large object, and they believe that large object was Venus, which was
right.
Displaced from where it was before the cometary debris came through.
I was actually going to ask you that, because that was Velikovsky's theory, that Venus was initially a comet and had disrupted the axis of the Earth at some point.
Yeah, Velikovsky's work, he thought it was much later, 4,000 or 5,000 BC, but his scholarship and the basis of his work is incredibly important, and he is held in such high esteem by people now because of all the things he worked out that we now begin to realize had actually happened.
Yeah, and well, it's also possible that Venus could have made a close pass to us and still roamed around the solar system for a little bit too.
Yes. Yes.
Do you follow any of the electric universe ideas?
Yes, all the time. Walter Thornhill, all the team at the Electric Universe. I met actually Walter Thornhill and David Talbot at the conference, which was held in 1997 at Fitzwilliam College, Cambridge, that was what got me really interested in so much of the work, what we've been talking about. And the Electric Universe has given us so many explanations of what happened in the past. David Talbot's work is particularly interesting because it demonstrates that the people around at the time understood plasma, and the things that were the thunderbolts, if you like, which were made and shaped and drawn by our ancestors, they understood plasma technology. And that, I think, is a very, very important point when we're looking for an advanced civilization, which what I'm suggesting is we did have an advanced civilization.
How advanced do you think they were?
Well, if they were able to genetically modify all sorts of material to produce the whole range of farming crops. Now, that may have taken many thousands of years prior to the catastrophe, but clearly they were able to do a lot of advanced work, as is described in the genetic work of in vitro fertilization. This is what is described in the Bible. And we had our sort of rather archaic understanding of that, but now it's clear they used in vitro fertilization, which is something that happens every day around the world now. The crops which they left to us were so good that we can't improve upon them now. That's one of the most interesting things. So if you look at spelt wheat, nobody can understand how spelt wheat had been produced other than by very advanced genetic manipulation, which, again, we're now beginning to understand and use to advantage, I believe, in most cases.
So do you think that the people who survived knew where to go to survive, or was it just by luck?
I think they knew. I think they knew exactly where to go. I think they were very well informed. They really couldn't have chosen a better place than the anti-Lebanon, all the snow melt water, a south-facing slope, a lake bed which they drained and then used to grow crops by providing an incredible system of irrigation, which was being able to control the water table in that basin. And so we see a whole range of sophisticated technologies arriving at that point, one of which was the manufacture of lime. Their lime plaster was so good that it can see it today on the Jericho Tower. And, of course, lime is the vital component of agriculture to be able to neutralize the acidity of your soil and get the soil just right for growing crops.
Okay. How do you think Göbekli Tepe fits into all of this?
Göbekli Tepe has all the hallmarks of the Watchers and the Angels. I'll come to those later, but we're talking about three groups of people, very well ordered, very disciplined. The archangels, of which there were seven, and then there were the angels, and then there were the watchers. Now, the archangels were called the two-eyed serpents, the angels were called the one-eyed serpents, and the watchers, that name is obvious. They were watching, but they weren't quite as senior as the angels, the one-eyed serpent or the two-eyed serpents. Much later, we see statues of four faces. So if you're looking in four directions with all with both eyes, then you've got a much wider view of the world. It was a symbol, if you like, of intelligence, really. But Göbekli Tepe is very interesting because it's on the top of a hill. And at that particular point in time, there was no farming, but there were a lot of wild animals moving north, and there would have been animals that would have survived the very cold weather, and they would have been hunted by these people for food. So if you're on the top of a hill, you can actually look down into the valleys on either side and see where your food is coming from and go down and deal with it. You see exactly the same behavior patterns of the settlements in New Mexico between the Clovis and Folsom people. And you've got an example there of similar kind of hunter-gatherer behavior, and finding that the top of the hill is actually the warmest place because you've got the sun all day long. As soon as you get into those valleys and the sun goes down, it gets very, very cold and unpleasant. So that's a key point. We don't seem to know where they got their water from. They must have had some arrangements for water at that particular point, and I hope somebody at Göbekli Tepe will work out where their water supply came from. But what we see are a whole range of circular structures, not unlike Stonehenge in basic principle, with prefabricated roof supports. And what would have done on top of those roof supports, very strong roof supports, would have put a very strong timber roof. And on top of that very strong timber roof, they would have had lots of earth, and earth, stones, anything they could put on top to build it up. Now, that was the way in which the Long Barrows were built and the Etruscans built structures in this very, very similar style, more sophisticated, but the same basic principles to literally, as the Druids would say, hide from the sky falling, or hide from the wrath of God, as it was called. And the story of Baalbek is that Cain built Baalbek to hide from the wrath of God. In other words, very large stones, the biggest stones at the top, which is an indication of wanting to protect it from massive blasts. And then right underneath you have your place to go and hide and store all your valuables and survive, hopefully, for some period of time, particularly if you've got fresh water supply, which they had at Baalbek from the Great Spring. So there were the Göbekli Tepe, it's only partly excavated. The carvings are of all the extraordinary, they would have been all the animals at the time, principally the fox, for example. When we look at very early Jericho, we find that the principal part of their diet was foxes in the very earliest stages, the red fox. And we see the fox on the columns at Göbekli Tepe. And a lot of other the sort of things that a group of intelligent people would say, well, let's have a little sculpture of all our friends that we're seeing every day around us. And clearly it was a place to hide from the remaining debris that might have been falling from the extreme cold, and an outpost undoubtedly, maybe at the same time as Karsag below Mount Hermon, but it was clearly in operation before the actual start of farming itself. Now, farming didn't start around Göbekli Tepe until about something like 600 or 700 years after the conditions in the Levantine corridor were ideal, as the planet began to warm up. And as the planet began to warm up and the ice to melt, then all the various plants marched north. And there was a lot of work done saying that we find Emma wheat in Anatolia, but all the earliest Emma wheat grains are found in the Levantine corridor and close to Jericho.
Okay, do you think Göbekli Tepe is the oldest site we have?
I don't think we've got anything as sophisticated any earlier. But it is contemporary with Jericho and Karsag. It's very important. Graham Hancock's book, I know Graham well. He's done some fantastic work. But one of my colleagues has written a review of Graham's book and saying, where is the missing chapter? Why haven't you put the O'Brien information in about the Garden of Eden site? Graham does talk about the Shining Ones and Mount Hermon, which is great, and he talks about Baalbek. But I believe that his work, combined with the O'Brien work, cracks the big nut so that the whole planet can actually now begin to look at the facts, that we have all the evidence we need for the existence of an advanced civilization and totally benevolent people. They had a hard time surviving, and a small number of them started again, and they left for us all manner of important things like food, a food system, a farming system. They even had all the basic laws which we saw later in the very early stages of Sumeria and the city-states. But of course, Sumer didn't start until about 5,500 BC, which is 4,000 years after we saw this restart in the Levantine corridor. And of course, the founding of Damascus, Byblos, Tyre, Sidon. We're looking here at a much earlier period than Sumer. Sumer would have been subject to massive floods as the ice melted over Anatolia and wouldn't have been suitable for farming until that much later date. And then they had a very much easier task, I think, to get civilization going because of the conditions in Sumeria, as it's called.
What are your thoughts on the age of the Sphinx?
My view on the Sphinx is that it is much earlier than the Great Pyramid. I think that's been fairly well established now. It faces due east, precisely due east, so it required the same knowledge and technology to position it as the Great Pyramid and other pyramids did. My own personal view is I know that that there have been suggestions that it's a dog. My own personal belief is I'm trying to think so many things at the same time. It's a cheetah. And I'll tell you why I believe it's a cheetah. When the Sphinx was built, the whole of that area was open savanna, full of wildlife, full of small deer, dik-diks, everything you see in South Africa, and a wonderful variety of game. And I believe that the Lloyd Pye made the case for the fact that the cheetah is a mixture of dog and cat. It's quite an extraordinary animal. It's naturally friendly to human beings. It's almost naturally domesticated. And my view is that it was one of the products of the genetic modification of the Shining Ones. And they produced the Sphinx to go out hunting with. A very sophisticated lurcher, if you like, to hunt for small game. For the pot, to feed them. A companion and a pet.
And what about the pyramids? Do you think the dating on those are accurate?
Yes. I think the dating of 2,500 BC is accurate. The boat beside the Great Pyramid, which was in kit form, that boat was 160 feet long, and when the cedar timbers were dated on that boat, it dated to 4,500 BC, which is 3,500 BC, which is 1,000 years earlier than the Great Pyramid. John Gagnon produced an excellent book, which is called The Message from the Ancestors. That was the first name for it. And he makes the case for the fact that the Great Pyramid, within the Great Pyramid, is encoded this terrible catastrophe at 10,850, and a warning of the great catastrophe which subsequently wiped out the Golden Age in 2345. In other words, they've been clever enough to not only all the magic and the mathematics and the incredible skills in producing the great pyramid. And about that time, remember, and over a period of 100 years, 100 pyramids were built or attempted. And you can see the process of learning before they got to the Great Pyramid. And what many people don't know is that slightly smaller than the Great Pyramid was the pyramid at Abu Rawash above Cairo, which was pink granite, which was absolute perfection in terms of pyramid construction and beauty, and had a massive chamber inside for people to go and take shelter from what they thought was going to be another catastrophe similar to the one in 10,850. Now, the key points about the Great Pyramid are, we know that pretty well, they weren't built by Egyptians, they were built by the elite from Sumer, who had to move from Sumer because the monsoon rains moved south, and you had a situation where Sargon I, whose dates are much earlier, 2700, Sargon I had a son called Menes. He had a wonderful daughter who took over as well, and he migrated down the Silk Road with the Bak Singh tribes to China. So much of Chinese civilization comes from Sumer. In Britain, England and America, we still use 100 Sumerian words in our everyday language today. But the key point is that Menes arrived to unite Egypt, and he was the principal leader of all the most knowledgeable Sumerians who built the pyramids. Now, there's another twist on this, is how did they know there was going to be another great catastrophe? Well, we find that Menes actually dies in Ireland, and he was stung by either a bee or a hornet. And this is all recorded by L.A. Waddell, who was the great language specialist and archaeologist in the early part of the 1900s. Lieutenant Colonel L.A. Waddell. Absolutely brilliant work, essential work for people to understand. And the O'Brien, one of his first tasks was to survey all the great stone cairns on Bodmin Moor in Britain. And at about 2,500 BC, this magnificent observational astronomy university, built by the Druids and to teach people who went to learn their education under the Druids. And that would have been the place, I think, where the advanced observational astronomy knowledge was gathered and where the warning was sent to the Egyptians, look, we've got a big problem coming. You better build some really good shelters in case we have the same problem we had before. Now, all that energy, all that work, all that stone, all that precision, all that technical skill was certainly not used for burying people. It was for keeping the population alive, no uncertain terms. They all had water supplies. The mastabars had the link into the water supply, so each of the mastabars were for family groups who couldn't get into the main pyramids. All the most valuable things were stored in the Great Pyramid itself. And when the problem had passed, then there was no worry then for the future for a while. So we're looking all the time at more and more solid evidence of what has happened to this planet, which is very serious cometary debris issues, which have virtually wiped the planet out at certain times. You know, we start with the dinosaurs, we can go on. And the work of Professor Victor Klube, who was the chief astrophysicist at Oxford University, who had all this wrapped up, and it's there at the end of Learning from History Part 1, and you can see the torrid stream, and you can see that he predicted that we would be going into the next torrid stream starting in the year 2000. And so... This is, I think, what Graham Hancock is saying, that we have a high risk and that we should all be thinking about what has happened in the past, what happened in Russia with that comet that exploded and the power unleashed, what happened at Tunguska and in 1908, an area the size of Belgium was flattened, and there have been two other major cometary impacts in the last 100 years, and they're on that list which I provided at the end of Learning from History Part 1.
Okay.
Now, you said there was another event at 2500 BC?
Yes. This coincides with the destruction at Sodom and Gomorrah, which was very well recorded recently on the television program, and that the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah was from cometary debris. It ties in with a whole group of meteor strikes or comet strikes from the Mediterranean right the way through to China in this year, 2345. It's something that came up and was talked about a lot at this conference at Fitzwilliam College, and it was organized by Benny Pizer. But I think that there's a realization now that we had the archaeologists saying, oh yes, but they all fought each other. Sitchin said it was an atomic bomb. And we now are grown up, I think, and think that it was, we now know what it was. It was cometary debris. And it had a major effect. It was, it literally destroyed the Golden Age. It finished the Golden Age. Massive loss of life, massive destruction. And you had all those wonderful Sumerian cities. And remember, Sumer was a confederation of all the great city-states. Sargon I, a key figure, we don't see a Sumerian king before about 3150. That's something else that Waddell has provided us with, which is an accurate dating of the Sumerian kings. And of course, the story of the Sargon I going to China and taking all the refugees, if you like, from Sumer to China, because they had a previous impact at 3127, which brought Europe to an end, but a much smaller impact. But it was at that time, it was sufficient. They began to see the desiccation of the Sumerian area, the Tigris and Euphrates area. We see Lake Chad in Africa at a peak of about 4000 BC. That was the highest level of Lake Chad, when the whole of the desert areas out from the Nile all was rich in the savanna landscape. And then we get this big change of the monsoon rains going south, again, climate change, but not caused by termites or humans. And I mention that because termites produce 10 times as much CO2 as humans, but far more serious problems, real problems of what comes in from outside.
Okay. You mentioned earlier that the angels and the watchers and such were all different groups. Can you get into that a little bit?
Yes, they were. They were very well organized. They were teams of 10, 50, 100, and 200 watchers arrived on Mount Hermon in the days of Jared, as one of the texts. They were extremely well organized. Their system was based on craftsmanship, as was the city-states. If you go to Mari on the Euphrates at 3000 BC, you will find there were over 200 craft trades and guilds. Now, we have craft trades and guilds still, the remains of it. But one of the laws in place at that time was that if you, for example, were a stonemason, you were not allowed to tell a carpenter what to do. And if you were a carpenter, you weren't allowed to tell a stonemason what to do. Each craft had his specialist subject across the whole range of important roles of people in society. And that included women, who played a full and equal role with men. We did not have any problems with the equality of men and women until about 1800 with the Assyrians, when they started putting veils on women. In Britain with the Druids, women had total equality, a whole range of craft skills and trades and roles, and equality with men right up to the time of the Roman invasions. But so you, the Watchers really, they really, you find, if you look at all the text, you find that their specific skills are listed in the Bible. Shemjazzar, for example, his task was root cuttings. That's a nice close link to agriculture. And enchantments. We don't really know what enchantments were, but that's clearly another problem for the translators to work out exactly what so much of this material actually said, because the fact that it was all put together by Ezra, or the Torah, the Bible, the Jewish Bible, was put together by Ezra in exile in Babylon around about 500 BC. Well, that was about 9,000 years after the event, and we had the earliest picture language, we had the earliest Aleph Beg at these very early dates of 9,500 BC, and the cement Basarat tokens at Jericho, and found all around the Fertile Crescent, and there as early as 9,000 BC. And they were the double-entry bookkeeping system, so that a farmer made the little clay tokens, which he fired, and kept one himself. So if he took four cattle into the marketplace, then he handed that to the man at the gate or the man in charge of the market as his record of what he had provided. I'm stretching around a bit here, but it is important that when we don't want to criticize anybody, we just want to enlighten everybody and look deeper into what we now know, look deeper into these translations, and do as O'Brien did. He learned that you had to go back to the very early cuneiform and picture language to be able to understand what the meanings of the words were.
Okay. Who were the Nephilim? Or the Nephilim?
Nephilim. I think that the word the Nephilim essentially were a group of very tall, large watchers. They came in all sizes. The Iggy were the little ones. We find that the small ones were strong and very well built and were absolutely ideal at digging tunnels and mining. We find that amongst this group, we had some very tall people. As I say, they were all grouped in sections rather like an army. So the Nephilim were one of the groups of craftsmen who were involved in particular tasks and jobs. Don't think any more than that. The key point to remember is that before the great catastrophe at 10,850, the Earth's atmosphere was very much denser. And we know this when you put a fish in a tank and increase the atmospheric pressure, the fish will live twice as long and grow to twice the size. So we may be looking at people who had survived the great catastrophe, and there may have been very tall, very large people. That explains all the talk about giantism or giants, and the enormous number of Homo sapiens bones that are found of people who are up to 16 feet tall. They're there. We shouldn't argue about it. There's no dispute. They're there. They can be looked at in vast numbers.
Okay. That was going to be my next question, too, about the different giant bones found around the world.
Yeah.
Do you think they just died out because of the atmospheric changes?
I think there was a tendency for people to become smaller than they were because of a thinner atmosphere. I think that's one possibility. And remember, there weren't that many of them in terms of population. It was a small group of people starting again, and they were clearly survivors. There weren't a mass of people. What we saw over the next 2,000 years after their arrival in 9,500 was they'd taken seeds and technology all around the world to the seven so-called farming sites. So they traveled the world and delivered their technology within a period of 2,000 years. And that's very well backed up. And that's all, a lot of that material is on Learning from History, Part 14.
What are the sites?
Well, the traditional view is that farming started, there was the obviously the Near East start, but then there were sites in America, Asia, around the world, where you find the first farming. The point I'm making is they weren't all independently developed at the same time. It seems crazy that very complex agriculture and very complex seeds were independently delivered by independent groups round about the same time. It doesn't take much sense to see that somebody took it. One good example is a shining one called Fuxi, who was farming in China at before 8,000 BC, and the mountain grain, the small mountain grain, as it's described in the Karsak tablets, is Italian millet. And so we find Italian millet in China at 8,000 BC, and a shining one called Fuxi planting it. So that's just one example, lots more. And of course, we got all the stories of the feathered serpents in the Americas. And of course, these people were called serpents, which meant nothing to do with snakes whatsoever. But it was they were wise people in all the different craft, trades, and skills. And O'Brien deals with that really well in The Shining Ones. The Bible even talks about wise as a serpent. And Adam and Eve were having discussions with the serpent in the Garden of Eden. So when we're looking at this Karsak site, we can see Enlil's great house and exactly where Adam and Eve were talking to the serpent in the garden. And it was a flat-topped hill, wonderful views into the North Basin and South Basin, Rishaya. It has the shape of a dog's head. You can see whether it's being built on now. This is why we want to protect it. This is the most important archaeological site in the world being developed for housing. Hence the reason for people to please come and support us and stop something really, you know, just get this protected and properly organized.
Now when you look at the whole Adam and Eve story, was that just mythology that built up over time, or did that have some relevance to the original story?
It has relevance to the original story, but the Bible takes all these things, and we've had two major problems with the Bible, in that Eve was sinful, of course, and Adam and all the rest of it. And so they've used this story to denigrate women, and that is absolutely outrageous. And also, they've used the story of the recording angel judging people as a matter of whether they were sinful or not, which was nonsense. They were simply observing people. And so this is where we get the nonsense of original sin. And so what the religions have done and the churches have done have distorted the truth to push their own particular method of controlling people. And the worst of all, I think the denigration of women is the most outrageous nonsense, which still continues. But the second issue is this question of original sin. And our two top men, Cholestius from Ireland and Pelagius from Bangor-on-Dee, were sent by a synod at Winchester to Rome to argue with Augustine of Hippo, who brought in this concept of original sin into the Catholic religion. Of course, says, you're all sinful, but don't worry, pay us some money and we'll forgive them. The most massive confidence trick racket that's ever been perceived on the planet. And that's why, of course, we reached a point too in the time of Thomas Cromwell and Henry VIII, when the whole population of England were supportive in the dissolution of the monasteries, because they'd just gone to ridiculous extents in raising money and distorting the truth.
So the Shining Ones were the survivors of this ancient civilization, and the people they were teaching, these are the people who just happened to survive of the more native population, I guess?
Yeah, they do talk about a small local population. And the in vitro fertilization was with the local women and impregnating the local women with the sperm of some of the shining ones. Now, the two things here. First of all, that is, if you like, selective breeding, which we understand from every animal farming point of view. And it was because they needed skilled workers. It was a crucial survival function to provide skilled workers. And it's another issue which O'Brien deals with. It's a very sensitive issue for people, I know. But all the evidence is that they had problems with their genetic modification, and that's mentioned. But I think, by and large, you'll find, I think these people were totally benevolent, totally brilliant. They left their civilization for us. Where would we have been without them? This is the point. And they needed skilled labor. And this is one of the ways they got it. We don't know how much of it was done, but we know it was done, and it's referred to, and it's explained again by O'Brien in the book Shining Ones.
So were the Shining Ones humans like we are now?
Yeah, absolutely. They were no doubt about it that they were. If we crossed with them, which we did apparently, then it all show up in the DNA. But what we've got when we look at the DNA, we actually find that every single person on the planet, including Aborigines, Africans, Eskimos, you name it, we all have a common male ancestor at about 40,000 BC. Mm-hmm. Very, very important. And so we're all very closely related, whatever our scarlet color, skin, belief, everything. The tragedy is we've all gone off in different directions because the truth has been distorted and abused with methods of controlling people.
Yeah. Well, I guess the last question I have for you right now, what role did the whole myth of Noah's flood play in all this? Where does that fit in?
We don't see Noah really until we get to Sumer. Sumer is a story from Sumer. And there were instructions given to build a large boat in Sumer. But I think personally that when we're talking about arcs, we talk about the Ark of the Covenant, we talk about Noah's Ark, they're just wooden boxes. And I don't believe it was a big boat at all. I think it was a box of seeds. It was a box of survival material. And you see various quotes which would support that. So Noah's flood undoubtedly was a Sumerian local flood. But, of course, we know from the text that it is recorded there was a worldwide flood. And that right. Worldwide flood, of course, was what Richard Firestone is describing in the cycles of cosmic catastrophe. And
so would that be the myths of these massive floods in all these different cultures?
Yes, they've all got the stories. And it's a wonderful book, Cycles of Cosmic Catastrophe. You've got all the ancient legends across America and around the world, and you've got the same basic message. The gods warned them that there was going to be a big problem. And the gods said, go dig a large hole or pit, cover it with logs and earth and hide. Simple. So the gods must have been around. And the gods knew what was going to happen because they were sufficiently advanced in their knowledge of astronomy. And the local people followed the instructions.
So do you think there was like two different types of culture then, this higher society, the shining ones and such, and a more primitive version of humans?
Yes, I think that's right. I think if you look at the history of the human race, there have been a whole range of levels of sophistication. You find, for example, in Britain and Ireland, with Wales in the middle, you find the Druidic traditions very, very important. And you find that the Druids were far more sophisticated and much earlier than Greece or Egypt. because the elite from Sumer had started coming into the British Isles from about 4,200 and probably much earlier. We've recently discovered domesticated wheat in the Solent, which is now under the water in southern England, dated at 6,000 BC. So Britain was a repository of, if you like, refugees from the drying out of the Sumerian region, the Indus Valley region, and Sahara. And the Greek letters, which we talk about, Marta Bernal, in his book, Black Athena, makes it perfectly clear the Greeks received their letters from the Druids. And that was the Eilif Beg. It was the in-house writing, which had existing right from the very earliest times and was kept in-house. And the attitude was, we don't want to give everybody the in-house writing. We'll give the ordinary people the sign language. You know, if you're crossing Europe, you have simple sign language to follow on the roads. But the pictorial text, there were 400 or 500 pictures which eventually were turned on their side and altered and then became the preserve of the scribes, and nobody could understand it. And then when our archaeologists and linguists tried to look at this work, they didn't go back to the beginning as O'Brien did. They went to the Akkadian and then tried to work backwards, which was absolutely a hopeless way of doing it. You start from the beginning, and if they'd started as O'Brien did, he was the only person who could see that you had to start with the simple picture language, which is very easy to understand, and see how that evolved. And he did that in order to be the only person able to fully translate the Karsag tablets from Manipa Tablet House. Now, the Reverend George Barton could work out about 20% of it because he supported the concept of starting with the 500 or 600 or 400 or 500 picture signs. And he made that clear, and it was firmly established in George Barton's time that you had to start with the picture language. But the problem is, we lost so many of our top scholars in the First World War that everything came to a halt until about the 60s. And then Samuel Noah Kramer began to look at it. And it was really a Christian O'Brien who was probably the most important exploration geologist in the last 100 years, and literally went to the top of BP and got his CBE. And he was the man, when he retired, is I going to sort this out? And he did sort it out. And of course, not being an archaeologist, nobody wants to know. All the great discoveries have been made by people who had incredible multidisciplinary skills. And it's very important to realize that we cannot rely upon archaeologists to dig into the truth and tell us exactly what happened.
Yeah, yeah. The multidisciplinary thing seems very important with a lot of these fields, because otherwise it becomes isolated and you don't get, you know, the coverage that's needed to really understand it.
Well, you upset all your colleagues if you step out of line. And that's the problem. That's the real problem is with academia, is that they all learn the books, they get their certificates, their PhDs, their doctorates, and their professorships for one particular subject, and then they tell everybody else what to do on other subjects. And we need to go back to where we were in Sumer, where the carpenter wasn't allowed to tell the stonemason what to do, and vice versa.
Yeah. All right. So people can find you actually have is it 14-part video series now?
Yes, it's I've got part 11 is shortly to go on as just a PowerPoint, which was my first attempt at understanding who St. Thomas was. And part 13 is the life and times of Jesus, under production at the moment. And the point about those two was, they were twin brothers, and they came for adoption in Britain at Colchester on the instructions of Augustus and Tiberius, and they were adopted by Tascovanus Tavantius at Colchester because he'd lost his two boys fighting for the Romans in Germany. And so Jesus was adopted, and he became the most important British king in AD 10 at the age of 17, and he was appointed the first Pendragon of the Britannic Isle, first King of Kings, and he did a fantastic job until about AD 27, and he left a big family, and he was asked to go to Judea to sort out the Judean problem by Tiberius Caesar. And this is a fantastic story. It fills in the gap of Jesus' missing years, and it makes the whole point that when Jesus was talking on the Sermon on the Mount, he was saying exactly what would have been said by an archdruid. He was an archdruid. Christianity was a restatement of Druidism, and Druidism had been in business right back to the origins of Carsag. And you find Jesus and Thomas. Thomas took the same knowledge, the same concept that Jesus talks about, straightforward, simple Christianity, to the East. It was based at Edessa, and the Christianity went right the way across to China through the what's called the Syriac Church. Islam was founded basically in that Eastern Christian tradition. And we find that Buddhism, no different to Druidism. We find that Jesus, absolutely clear, Jesus was having regular meetings with Thomas in India. And Jesus, coins were minted with Jesus' head and a head of Buddha in Kashmir. Great deal more evidence now available to give us a really good story about a fantastic man who still is the most important man on the planet. And all you got to do is learn by heart the Sermon on the Mount, and also follow what he and Confucius had to say, which is to do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Respect the rights of others as you would have your own rights respected. And that applies to companies and countries and everybody involved in trying to run the planet.
Yes, absolutely. Where can people find your video series?
On YouTube. Just Google YouTube. If you can't find it on YouTube, put Edmund Marriage YouTube. And if you can't find it there, go on to the goldenageproject.org website. I'm planning to do a big update of the website soon. It's about 12 years old. I haven't had to update it or change it much, but it is a bit rusty, so please forgive that. But you'll find the material all there under video lectures.
Yes, and if people want to see the evidence of what you've been talking about this last hour, that is the place to do it.
That's right. And remember, my best one to start with is Learning from History, Part 14. But for many people, start with Learning from History, Part 1. That gives you all the cometary debris problems and also explains climate change very well, which has now been solidly proven and not to be man-made. On that basic thesis by Hans Fenmark and Nigel Calder in their book, The Chilling Stars. Very important, with Victor Kluge's work on cometary debris problems at the end of part one. And also look at part 10, because that's a much broader explanation of how things evolved from 9,500 BC, how we can track back to the Garden of Eden site and face the reality of what I believe is now undisputed.
All right. Well, good luck on the trip, and maybe when you get back, we can have you back on to tell us how everything went.
I'd love to.
All right. Thank you so much, Edmund.
Thank you, Sir Ryan.
All right. So hopefully we'll have Edmund back sometime in November, maybe near the end. I think we're booked up until November at this point. We have some really interesting stuff coming up next month, including having Steve Stockton on Halloween, and he'll be telling us some of his own scary stories and experiences that night. Should be a fun time. All right, so I'm going to leave you with some brand new stuff from Mechanism. We've been playing one song from their first album, Bring Back the Sun, here and there over the shows, and they have a new album out called The Shift, Anthems for a Revolution, and I've interviewed them about this, and I'm going to have more stuff up. If you're interested in checking that out, you'll have to go to thelastexit.org, my underground music show, where you can find interviews with this band.
You can also go to mecha-nism.com for more. And I'm going to play something off this new EP. It's a very spiritual EP, to say the least. It's very energetic, very empowering, a little heavy. And we're going to check out a song called Mouth of God. So that is what I'm going to leave you with this week. Mecha-nism. See you next week.
Legend inside us, the spirit reminds us from the